Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We're going to take you into the weekend this hour with some questions about money. And some suddenly in trouble billionaire money managers. And we'll talk about face values. If you even use cash anymore, we're asking whose face, besides some dead presidents, should be on the paper money in the U.S. We've had Susan B. Anthony on the dollar coin. Sacagawea is there now, as all you slot players in Vegas know pretty well. What other woman would you put on the face of U.S. currency? Noting that the British 10-pound note will soon have the face of Jane Austen, let's get some suggestions. Powerful, successful, high-profile, intelligent women. One of you out there, listener Tony Powell, suggests Marian Anderson, Emily Dickinson. How about Toni Morrison, Oprah, Amelia Earhart, Eleanor Roosevelt? This week it might be the wife of Anthony Weiner, Huma Abedin, or Hillary Clinton. Powerful, successful women who are also long-suffering spouses. But we're going to begin this hour by concluding our series on caregivers in America. You've been a real part of that. The long-suffering, unrecognized more than 65 million caregivers who are also witness to extraordinary compassion. You've all taught us a lot this week about responsibility, about love, community, and family. Your stories have been amazing. Thanks so much for reaching out. Tyrone, down in Georgia, called to say caregiving is a two-way street.
I never thought I would live long enough to do what I was doing. When I'm seen as I'm blind and couldn't do for myself and nobody else. But thanks to the good Lord, things changed, and they changed just in time. So I was able to help my mom and be a help to my family when at one time everybody was waiting on me. So I'm thankful and I'm grateful.
You can find us at 877-8MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org or tweet us using the hashtag #ICareFor. We're going to conclude our series now with a shout-out to families dealing with a severely injured veteran from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Due to medical and technological advancements, these wars have seen higher survival rates of injured military personnel than ever before. 95% of troops wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan survive. Injuries that would have been lethal in Vietnam or Korea become long-term disabilities of a kind we are only now even beginning to understand. In our final caregiver profile, we talked to Valerie Brown, whose son, Sergeant John Barnes, served his country in Iraq. Now Valerie is serving her country and her family by taking care of her soldier son, who has a permanent traumatic brain injury and partial paralysis. She has become his sole caregiver, a journey that began for this mom when Sergeant Barnes was discharged from an Army hospital years ago.
His discharge instructions were, call us if you need us. And I had the false belief that my son had made a miraculous recovery and he was going to go on to lead a fulfilling, happy life, although he's partially paralyzed on the left side of his body and has this, you know, traumatic brain injury. It wasn't until he left home a couple months later and moved into his own apartment, where all of a sudden the structure and the supervision were no longer in place, that he spiraled out of control. It didn't hit me till then that my son was worse off than I thought, than I knew him to be, and also worse off than what the so-called experts within the VA realm believed him to be.
So many caregivers have described that they have to stand in for tasks that the person that they're caring for can't do, you know, simple tasks, maybe cleaning themselves, maybe washing, maybe walking even.
Right, right.
In your case, though, you're standing in for your son's brain.
Correct. And it's a full-time job. We try never to leave him unsupervised because even though he's 29, he's trapped in adolescence. So a lot of times he behaves like an impulsive 14 or 15-year-old. So there's supervision. He can get into trouble very easy, and just like any teenager, boredom is a catalyst for disaster. Some kind of behavioral issue can take place because he's bored. Impulse control is a huge thing. You have to be very careful when you take him out in public because that filter is not there. If he's tired or his blood sugar's low, it's a bigger problem. He's more impulsive in his speech. He says very hateful things, very loud. So being out in public with him is a challenge. He gets overstimulated and overwhelmed very easily, so it's hard to take him out in crowded areas. Traveling with him is very difficult for him because of the overstimulation. So it's being vigilant and careful with him and for him 24/7.
Can you describe a moment where he was directing some emotion or behavior at you and you had to just hold on and realize it's not who I think it is, it's the injury?
Right.
How did you do that? And just describe that incident if you could.
That is almost on a daily basis. But I think the thing that stands out the most with me is one Christmas, his son was with us visiting, and John just got overstimulated with all the activity in the house and the relatives in, and a simple act of his son, who had just gotten a Nerf gun for Christmas, shot the arrow at his dad's head. And that immediately brought a reaction from John. I don't know if it's tied to PTSD or something else, but he just lost it. And he went off on an explosive tangent. And so you have to recognize, okay, that's not him. That a normal person would not have reacted to that at all. But because of his brain injury, you just have to work your best that you see possible to de-escalate the situation and to let John know, okay, you know, I understand what just happened. I understand what's going on. It's okay. Why don't you step back and go to somewhere quiet?
Do you ever feel in danger?
I don't, even though there have been a couple incidences where he's been very, very explosively violent. I've never felt like he'd hurt me.
Do you ever feel like this will change, that this situation that you're in right now and this responsibility that you have right now will change in any way?
No, I've accepted it's not going to change simply because John is never not going to be brain injured. I think the best I can hope for is that through therapy and through time, John can learn better coping skills and learn different methods of expressing himself and learn to become more independent and self-sufficient so that he's a happier individual.
How has this changed you as a citizen?
I feel like I've been drafted. It literally has impacted every aspect of my life. Before his injury, I worked part-time. I had a wonderful husband. I lived in a huge house on the golf course. Just had a very happy, fulfilling life. And then all of a sudden, you get that phone call, and your son's just devastatingly injured. His wife left him. She took their newborn baby with them. So all of a sudden, you know, I'm dealing with being a caregiver, something I never wanted or expected to be doing. And you put your life on hold. And you do that willingly and lovingly. But in the beginning, you don't recognize this is forever. This is never going to change. John most probably will outlive me. So this is for the rest of my life. The burden of caring for him led to my divorce from my second husband, who was, you know, John's stepdad. Just the burden of that deteriorated the marriage. So all of a sudden, I found myself once again a single mom. A very scary time. I was financially ruined. I was back to working full time. I was back to having to find, you know, technically daycare for my son just so I could go to work. And then come home and be, you know, caregiver at home and make sure that John was safe and John was happy and John was getting everything he needed out of life. It's just impacted every aspect of my life, emotionally, physically, spiritually, it's unreal. And, you know, I recognize now there's a reason why they say being a caregiver takes 10 years off your life. I mean, it truly does. But, you know, last July, I met the most wonderful man, and we got married 3 months ago. He just loves my son and respects my son, and it has been the most rewarding blessing that's come into our life in 7 years.
So, Valerie, you know, this is a very, deeply important story about what's going on in America and the consequences of the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan and, what happens when America decides to do this or that overseas. And I guess what I'm yearning for is for you to add to that story. What does your experience tell us about service, tell us about responsibility, tell us about what it means to be all together in this American community, whatever decisions our government makes?
Well, unfortunately, I don't feel like there's any togetherness. When your child is devastatingly injured, as mine was, you do feel all alone. You do feel isolated and the situation bleak. I think America needs to wake up. There are hundreds of thousands of these brain-injured veterans, some more so than my son, and many, many more not so injured as mine. And we need to step up to the plate and recognize that this is a huge issue, and we need to change the way things are done. And the scariest thing for me is, like I said, my son is probably going to outlive me. Who's going to care for him?
Who's in your corner? Is the VA? Is the government? Is this recognized on the scale that you see it? Most Americans probably have no idea of what you're going through and how many people are going through the exact same thing.
I'm sure most Americans don't, and I wouldn't either if I wasn't living this. Ignorance truly is bliss. This is not a fun life. This is not a fun thing, and I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy, but I think the people that are the biggest, companions and champions in our corner are other caregivers. The VA clearly is so overwhelmed and behind the times with providing everything our brain-injured veterans need. It's very sad. It's very frustrating and very sad. But I think we look to each other, fellow caregivers, on our blogs, on our support systems, in our peer groups, in our support chats. That's our biggest supporters, each other.
Well, Valerie, thanks so much, and the best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
In Tampa, Florida, Valerie Brown is caregiver to her son, veteran Sergeant John Barnes, wounded in Iraq. We've got a way for you to visualize just what might be out there, the likelihood that a caregiver with a veteran is in your community. We've created a map of veterans by county across the United States. Go to thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Billion Dollar Cheaters, DOJ versus SAC. Going from billionaire to bust in one fell swoop. That's the prospect facing SAC Capital, the Wall Street hedge fund with a reputation for psychic insights into making money in the stock market. The Justice Department called SAC yesterday a magnet of market cheaters in a broad indictment of the firm run by billionaire Stephen A. Cohen, accusing it of systematic insider trading violations dating back more than a decade, insider trading that is, quote, substantial, pervasive, and on a scale without known precedent in the history of hedge funds. Joining us now is Ben Protest, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Ben, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So in general terms here, is this a shot across the bow to the entire hedge fund industry, or is it really just about SAC Capital?
No, I think it is a message that's being sent to not just the hedge funds, but Wall Street more broadly, and that when a fund is corrupt from the inside, as the prosecutors have alleged here, that it won't just be individuals who are charged, but perhaps the firm itself.
And describe this sense of a strategy or a culture of insider trading that seems to be what the Justice Department is outlining in this complaint, and tell us how far back it goes.
goes back to 1999 all the way to 2010. And they've identified about 10 people who they have linked to insider trading. Six of those, this is the important part, have already pleaded guilty. So that's where this becomes a really difficult legal effort for SAC, because six of their former employees are ready to pretty much stand up in court and say, we committed insider trading. SAC failed to prevent us from doing so. And in fact, in certain cases, there were such major lapses in internal controls that it really almost enabled the behavior, is what the prosecutor said.
When SAC appears to stand for the initials of Stephen A. Cohen, who is the founder and the billionaire stock picker at the head of this corporation, can he individually be spared even though he hasn't been indicted?
For now, he personally, as far as, you know, handcuffs on him in the courtroom, going to prison or being charged, at least he so far has been spared. Investigation is ongoing. You know, when we talk to our sources, no one exactly kind of says this is over. They said we're still looking at this. This could drag on for quite some time. However, for now, it really does seem like he is personally spared. But keep in mind, of the roughly $10 or $11 billion that's in SAC right now, $8 billion of that is Steve's own money. So if the prosecutors try to pursue not only just shutting down the firm eventually, but really with making them forfeit all of their money, a good portion of that money is Steve's money himself. Now, they will protect the outside investors, and that money will be shielded. But Steve's money really is his fortune here is in the crosshairs.
Any comment from Stephen Cohen at this point?
They basically say that these six people who have pleaded guilty and a handful of others are really isolated cases, and it doesn't speak to kind of the broader culture of the fund. You know, five pages of the indictment, however, are dedicated to the lax controls and how this was pervasive. You know, so I think that it's a very difficult maneuver at this point for SAC and for Mr. Cohen.
How difficult is it for the prosecutors? Let's focus on this question of a scheme that the complaint outlines and the whole culture of hedge funds, which is about, you know, power meetings and Rolodexes and who knows whom and who's getting this information from whom. I have a difficult time sorting out what would be just normal Wall Street high-flying finance and what is an actual insider trading scheme.
Absolutely. And so what a lot of the individual defendants who've gone to trial, not just at SAC, but, you know, again, more broadly in the hedge fund industry, have alleged it or have responded to this with is, you know, this was research. This wasn't, you know, we were working our sources, just like a journalist work source or, you know, a researcher would work, you know, various sources of information. This is very customary, routine business. The government says you crossed the line, however, and the key thing here in the SAC matter is that they've already proven, or at least the six individuals have admitted to guilt. So the issue of whether or not insider trading was committed is a done, resolved matter. Now and under corporate criminal liability, you can attribute the criminal acts of employees to the fund itself. Basically, you know, as one person said to me yesterday, it's game over for SAC.
Game over. Wow. So
I mean, they have certain legal defenses that they can mount, but this is very soon it's going to become a discussion of pleading guilty and various charges to perhaps lesser charges. But this is there's very few routes here for SAC. Once you have six individuals admitting to illegal conduct at SAC, getting up there and testifying against the fund itself.
This is a, you know, stock-picking hedge fund. It's not necessarily involved or known for being a creator of exotic financial instruments like derivatives, et cetera. Did SAC Capital basically make the same mistakes as the Ivan Boeskys of the world, the Michael Milkins of the world, some sort of same temptations of insider trading going back decades? Or were they doing something new, more sophisticated that pushed the envelope?
It's routine insider trading that's been alleged here, right? It's just, you know, your average plain vanilla working a source, talking to somebody inside Dell ahead of their earnings and getting a sneak peek at it. It's getting, you know, information leaked from a doctor who's sitting on a drug trial, and drug trial is not public, and you're getting slides from a drug trial before the announcement. It's pretty routine, old-fashioned insider trading that's alleged. Now, some of these people have fought the charges, and like I said, there's been this discussion, was it just, you know, regular research and nothing across the line? But so far, the government has charged about 80 people, and 73 of those in the sweeping crackdown, 73 of those have either pleaded guilty or been convicted.
Sounds like game over to me. Ben Protest, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ben Protest, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Another film out today recalls the fatal shooting of a young black man on a tragic New Year's Eve in 2008. Oscar Grant was shot and killed after an altercation on a San Francisco Bay Area or BART train. The circumstances are still unclear, but a white police officer was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter in the incident. Fruitvale Station is both the BART platform where the incident took place and the name of the film that opens in theaters nationwide today. It stars Michael B. Jordan as Grant, who plays him both as a petty criminal who made a lot of mistakes in his life and as a father and young man with a lot of hope about his future. Cephas Bobby Johnson has seen the film. He's the uncle of the late Oscar Grant.
I have to say Michael B. Jordan really internalized Oscar's spirit to where he brought him to life on that screen, which was just tremendous for us and really made it even more painful when they concluded with the shooting of him again by Johannes Mezzali.
Do you think that there's at least the suggestion that Hollywood is exploiting a story that, you know, got a lot of press, and certainly with the Trayvon Martin killing, it you know, certainly strikes a very deep emotional chord, but it's unlikely that African-American men will benefit from anything that happens as a result of this film?
Well, I'm not sure that. I think most importantly that especially the black and brown community will look at this and see that these young men that mass media seem to portray as being criminalized, demonized, and in many ways demoralized, actually are young men that have families. You know, and in those families, they have forms of expression of love, you know, when they have children. Or when they have a mother, you know, in the form of respect and love. These young men, especially Oscar, in the sense, or more specifically Oscar, was loved. He was a father. You know, he was a son, an uncle, a cousin. He was a community member. And, you know, and we hope that that would resonate with the fact that, you know, so many of these young men today are experiencing these killings without a face of their humanity.
Do you think the reason that Oscar died is racism or the presence of a gun?
I would say it had more to do with racism, because what's not been talked about is Johannes Mezzali's history. We know for a fact that his first year on BART Police Department, he was in altercation with a young black man. Within that same year, he was in a second altercation with another young black man. His second year, he's in a third altercation, and he's reprimanded for that altercation in the way he performed the arrest. These are just facts. 45 days before Oscar was murdered, he beat up a young man named Kenneth Carruthers, where he was in civil litigation for that assault on that young man. There's many officers that's been employed for over 20 years and haven't had that many altercations and complaints filed against them for their act. The Peace Officer Bill of Rights protect that information from the jury, so that the jury can give a clear-cut analysis of how to bring back a verdict when it comes to police officers and a relationship with the black and brown community. So, of course, we know that, without a doubt, that it was much racism involved in that decision to pull the gun, because the first statement was, "Tony, I thought he had a gun." And then, of course, he claimed later he mistaken his taser or his gun for his taser. But that immediate response, there was no legal restraints from him stating that he was sorry. And so after he had claimed that he thought he had a gun, if he intended to use his taser, he would have immediately stated, not just to Oscar, but to the family, that he really is apologetic for that mistake. That never occurred, and it hasn't occurred to this day.
Well, Cephas Johnson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Cephas, Uncle Bobby Johnson is the uncle of the late Oscar Grant, the death of Oscar Grant depicted in the movie Fruitvale Station. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bart, in a statement, called the killing the most traumatic thing that's happened in Bart's history. Their complete statement can be read at thetakeaway.org.
I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here.
I heard what you're saying. You know nothing of my work.
Also, dude, Chinaman is not the preferred nomenclature. Asian American, please.
Actually, it's pronounced Miliwake, which is Algonquin for the good land.
Check out the big brain on bread.
Movie Friday. Welcome to Rafer Guzman and Kristen Mines are our movie team. Rafer, of course, film critic for Newsday. Kristen, culture producer for The Takeaway. Welcome, guys.
Happy Friday.
Hi, John.
Yes, indeed. Three movies we're going to talk about. First of all, he's back, Hugh Jackman, and he's not a French guy with a big vibrato. Listen.
You have 10 words. 10 words. To explain to me why you would want your fiancé killed by the Yakuza.
You don't have the faintest idea what's going on.
How many words was that?
9. 9.
You have 1 word left.
Wolverine of the X-Men franchise. Hugh Jackman plays the Wolverine. The range of this guy is extraordinary. Rafer, what did you think?
You know, I'm of the school of thought that I really don't want to see my superheroes wrestling with inner demons and, you know, turbulent psyches. I just want a guy who's going to deliver some punches and have some fun. And I think Hugh Jackman really does that well in The Wolverine. This is one of the most enjoyable superhero films I've seen in a long time.
Whoa, there's a rave. Kristen?
Wow, I can't believe it. I fully agree with Rafer on this one, which never happens. I enjoyed pretty much every minute of it, except for the last half hour final fight sequence, which seems to be in every comic book movie now, the fight sequence that goes on too long.
Wait, you're surprised there's a fight sequence in a comic book movie? What planet are you from?
But overall, it was such good fun. It opens with visually spectacular tragedy, and then it just continues on with all sorts of craziness and fun from there on.
I was not a fan of any of the X-Men movies, but I did think that character, Wolverine, had a huge amount of potential. I'm glad they picked it to exploit. They did a good job. Is there more Wolverines to come, do you think?
There's a hint at that. If you stay after the closing credits, and if you are a Wolverine or X-Men fan, definitely stay after the closing credits. You'll see a hint of something that might be coming next.
Oh, that's nice. Good suggestion there from Kristen Meinzer. This, of course, is the time of the year when you get the really infantile comedies coming out of Hollywood. The to-do list. Let's listen.
Please welcome to the stage president of Mathletes, as well as our own self-published magazine, Women with a Y, valedictorian Brandi Clark.
Get off the stage, virgin!
Teen sex comedy. Kristen?
Absolutely. And I love a good sex comedy. I think they're always tapping into our own insecurities, our own sense of fun. But so many of them are headed by men, and it's great to see one led by a really funny, smart woman. Women's pleasure getting attention, women's fun, women's insecurities. And I just had so much
fun. More conversations I have to have with my daughters. Thanks a lot.
Your daughters are going to love this as soon as they can go into a rated R movie.
What do you think?
Well, we should say this is Aubrey Plaza from Parks and Recreation as Brandi Clark. And she's really funny. She's awkward. She's endearing. It's a character she knows how to play well. I disagree with Kristen. I thought this was a fake feminist comedy. I think this is a lot of raunchy, gross-out humor with just some sort of lip service to feminism. But I don't think it works. I think it's really demeaning, degrading, unfunny. And I hated this movie. I hated it.
Split decision there. All right. On the last one, is this guy running on empty?
They saw you having lunch with her, taking her hand.
Oh, what crap? Who told you that? I know who. It was that vacuous troublemaker, Lydia. Am I right?
Were you?
It had to be Lydia because I was having a business lunch with Amy at the Four Seasons.
Did you take her hand?
Are you nuts? You think if I was having an affair, I'd be crazy enough to have it in public at the Four Seasons?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes you drink at lunch.
New York, lots of dialogue. Got to be Woody Allen. What do you think?
Reprehensible people acting reprehensibly, and I hated every minute of it.
absolute masterpiece. Social commentary from Woody Allen for one of the first times in years. Loved it.
Blue Jasmine is the film. Kristen and Rafer are movie critics. Rafer Guzman, Kristen Meinzer, film critic for Newsday, culture producer for The Takeaway. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, John.
And now the power struggle going on in Egypt, where an acting interim president is fighting an ousted former president for political credibility. Former President Mohamed Morsi has been formally charged with espionage. The circumstances, dating back to Morsi's escape from prison during the Egyptian uprising against former President Hosni Mubarak in 2011, Morsi allegedly conspired with the Palestinian militant group Hamas in his escape. The country's military leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, is calling for mass protests to tangibly demonstrate public support for the interim military government. Joining us now, Daniel Kurtzer, former U.S. ambassador to Egypt and professor of Middle East policy studies at Princeton University. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
This battle with Morsi sort of attacking his reputation, trying to discredit him as a terrorist, in the midst of trying to also demonstrate credibility, Fattah al-Sisi is really embarked on something that is puzzling to me in terms of where he's going to end up here.
Well, that question captures the situation exactly. On the one hand, this interim government, of which al-Sisi serves both as defense minister and the deputy prime minister, is looking for a way to reconcile with the Muslim Brotherhood in order to stabilize the situation in Egypt. And on the other hand, you have al-Sisi out there publicly calling for demonstrations. The escalation today of charging the former president, Mohamed Morsi, with espionage and conspiring with Hamas can only exacerbate the situation. And there's great concern that Egypt may be on a downward slide to a kind of a constant violence that could actually lead to civil war. It's a real worry today.
I guess I'm puzzled as to, you know, on the one hand, you could call this a do-over where the Muslim Brotherhood's reputation for governing really is so discredited by Mohamed Morsi's tenure as president. But you could just go back and do it again, hold new elections. It seems to me that General al-Sisi is insisting upon completely discrediting the Muslim Brothers as basically a condition for moving forward, and that is almost a prescription for civil war by my reading of the situation.
You know, for those who looked at the July 3rd action that deposed Morsi, it was in fact a situation of the third time might be a charm. You know, the military rule right after Mubarak was ousted from power didn't work out. The government under Mohamed Morsi didn't work out, and the hope was that a third time might allow this to happen. But what I think you're seeing is the newest iteration of an 85-year struggle between secularists and the Muslim Brotherhood ever since the Muslim Brotherhood's founding. And since the 1952 revolution, which brought first Gamal Abdel Nasser to power, then Sadat, and then Mubarak, the army has been the instrument to try to destroy the Muslim Brotherhood as an institution. And it may be that General al-Sisi, as part of that establishment, sees it as his historical mandate to push the Muslim Brotherhood off the scene. And that would be very dangerous.
Talking with Daniel Kurtzer, former U.S. ambassador to Egypt and professor of Middle East policy studies at Princeton University. Well, you're running short of constituencies or candidates here to run Egypt. What's next? A restoration of the monarchy, a Coptic Christian government in Egypt, or even the secular leftists could take over? Those seem three very unlikely scenarios, but what's left?
Well, exactly right. None of those scenarios works. Actually, the interim government that was established after Morsi was pushed from power is actually a good combination of people. There are some very fine, well-established technical experts and others who are well-known internationally. And if given a chance, this interim government might actually prove itself. I'm just not sure, as we've been talking, that the military's decision to go all out against the Muslim Brotherhood will actually give this interim government a chance to govern. You know, the timetable for change now is very constricted. There's supposed to be 4 months in which you have constitutional reform, you have a new election to the parliament, and then presidential elections. That can only work in a situation of stability and of calm. And if these demonstrations continue over the next weeks and months, those situations will not obtain, and the whole transition is going to fall apart.
To say nothing of there's an economic clock ticking, tourism is non-existent in Egypt during this period, not likely to return. Can the U.S. basically pay all of Egypt's bills while this process goes on?
Well, not only can we not, but we will not. The financing gap in Egypt is now running at $3.2 billion a month, which means that their revenues are falling short to that number. Their foreign exchange holdings have collapsed since the revolution 2 years ago. And not only tourism is absent, but also other sources of revenue. Suez Canal revenue is down. Expatriate labor is down. In other words, the kinds of things that traditionally have earned Egypt its income are all suffering rather significantly as a result of this instability. The United States simply doesn't have the wherewithal to cover that. In the past couple of weeks, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and some other Arab states have provided Egypt with an injection of funds that helps them in the short term. But you're talking about very short-term solutions to a long-term problem.
Daniel Kurser, former U.S. ambassador to Egypt and professor of Middle East Policy Studies at Princeton University. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, John.
Lots of economic headlines this week, from the SAC Capital Insider Trading indictments to the indictments of four Russians and a Ukrainian for a hacking operation involving 160 million credit card numbers, hundreds of millions of dollars in losses. But the big talk on Wall Street and Washington is who will replace Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke. He's been chairman since 2006, and after this January, we won't be hearing this voice anymore.
Our strategy is to try to focus on inflation and unemployment using monetary policy, but to pay close attention to any developments in the financial stability sphere and use the regulatory and supervisory tools we have as the first line of defense.
Financial stability sphere, the calm, measured, putting me to sleep voice of Ben Bernanke before the Senate Banking Committee, could be replaced by the bombastic, suffer-no-fools voice of former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, or the soft-spoken current Fed Vice Chairman and well-known expert on monetary policy, Janet Yellen. For more on who's in the running to be the next chairman of the Federal Reserve, we turn to Pippa Malgram, president and founder of Principalis, a financial firm based in London. Pippa, welcome back.
Hello.
Is there a serious debate between Summers and Yellen? One is a move up from within. Summers seems to be a real operator in Washington who wants some sort of redemption for all of his good works. But is there a policy difference between the two?
Oh, that's a good way of putting it. There is a policy difference between the two. I think Larry Summers would be much more inclined to deal with the economy more immediately. I think Janet Yellen has a very clear view that she wants the economy to fully recover before the Federal Reserve takes any action. So that's a little bit why the market views her as being more, quote, dovish, softer, and less willing to take away the stimulus until there's absolute certainty the economy is back on its feet, which for many people is going to be too late and will bring a new set of problems.
So the policy issue here is really this, quantitative easing, the thing that, Bernanke now calls the stimulus, which is the Fed's buying of Treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities. The question is when to stop this. Bernanke hinted that it might stop sometime soon, and the markets went insane. You say Summers would be more likely to be suspicious of the stimulus and pull it back early?
Yeah, well, he just said in the last couple of days, in fact, that he felt the quantitative easing was pretty, quote, ineffective. And that there were other things that might be more effective, which implies he's, not necessarily going to continue that policy if he is appointed. But I think at the end of the day, look, it's the president's decision. I think that he would very much like to make a historic announcement and announce the first woman chairman of the Federal Reserve. No question that Janet Yellen is fully, fully qualified. She's been described as a small woman with a large IQ, which is pretty apt. But I think the big difficulty is that whoever is in this job next, they're going to face a very divided committee. And an even bigger issue is that the Federal Reserve is telling the American public there's absolutely no inflation. And I think the American public are feeling their cost of living go up. And it may be that the Fed's models are wrong, and maybe the Fed's models are right, but the growing gap is going to increase distrust in the Fed.
Does the president have a vision of the Fed? Would he be wanting to put his stamp on the Fed, or is this simply a historic announcement of a woman appointment independent of economics in any way?
No, I think, look, all presidents want to put their stamp on the Fed. That's normal. But in this case, I think that he believes that her softer stance on the economy is the right thing to do. And it happens that she's fully qualified and that she is also a woman. And all those things add up in a world where actually there aren't that many other great choices. And I think, you know, this is a very difficult, tricky moment in the history of the U.S. economy. And the question of who's capable of managing the institutional differences is an open one. And I think, for example, Larry Summers doesn't have a great history of being a highly collaborative kind of character.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah. I saw a Social Network, and he'll be dealing with all sorts of egos on the board if he was made chairman of the Federal Reserve. And I think the question really is, since Jenny Yellen is vice chair, does she already deal with that group? Do they view her as some sort of a bridge builder, or do they want her out of the way?
Oh, that's an interesting question. And I think there are different opinions on that committee. I mean, I think that there are different opinions on that committee, not only about monetary policy, but also about what is the right way to manage the committee. I mean, in the past, for example, Alan Greenspan basically used to let everybody talk. And then he would say, now let me tell you why you're all wrong. And people were afraid to challenge him. Paul Volcker was very different. He just said, here's what I think, and never let anybody get in a word edgewise. Ben Bernanke's been quite different. He said, all right, let's all have a conversation and throw in our thoughts. But over time, the people who have a more hawkish approach on the economy have definitely felt that he is not as interested in their voice as they think he should be. So she's definitely going to face a tough group.
But Pippa, it seems to me that if you look back at some of those candidates, Paul Volcker, I've heard talk, would never get nominated today. He's just too divisive a character. The Fed chairmanship has evolved into a kind of technical position, an expert, an academic. Bernanke is certainly that. And Yellen is that, way more than Summers.
Oh, I agree. But I think the analysis is wrong. I think that the prime function of the Federal Reserve is to protect the currency and to protect the economy. And so, yes, there's a need for technical expertise, but this is not a technical function. This is a political role as well. And you're going to need political leadership for the Federal Reserve to maintain the trust of the American public in the value of the currency, in the capability of the economy to recover properly. So, no, I don't think it's enough to be an academic in that job.
And if Yellen is appointed to Fed chairman, she has a chance of getting her face on a dollar, maybe the 10 spot, 50. Who would you put on there if it wasn't a, dead American president?
I hear you. No, it's going to be a dead American president. But I tell you what she will face is on her first day going in front of Congress, that what she is doing is no longer what she learned in a textbook. It is politics. It's political theater. It's about managing expectations. It's a whole different skill set than you ever get doing a PhD in economics.
Pippa Malgram is president and founder of Principalis, a financial firm based in London. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So this week, the Bank of England announced that author Jane Austen will soon grace the £10 note, replacing Charles Darwin by 2017. In the U.S., you can find Sacagawea on the dollar coin. Susan B. Anthony was on the dollar coin. No woman on paper money, of course. You know that if you use cash anymore. We're asking you, which woman would you want to see on a U.S. banknote? Eleanor Roosevelt is a possible or is a popular choice with some of you. Rosa Parks, Tony Powell, I suggested at the top of the hour, one of our listeners, Marian Anderson and Emily Dickinson. Andrew from San Antonio would like to see Sally Ride on a $1 bill. Kurt suggests Dorothea Dix. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheTakeaway. And a thanks to all of you out there who were a part of our caregiver series. We heard so many wonderful stories of people, part of the 66 million folks. You can go back and listen to them at thetakeaway.org. And when I came into work today, there was a huge stack on my desk from Today's Caregiver Magazine, thrilled with our series and wanted to offer some suggestions for getting more information, including the book, The Fearless Caregiver. You can find all that information at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.